Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of June. All things political coming up this hour. We'll have two guests, Philip Klein, senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. We'll talk to him about many subjects. He did comment recently on the debt and said in a recent column, yes, there is still a debt problem. We'll get to that at some point during our conversation with him. Also, Sam Stein joining us, political editor and White House correspondent for the Huffington Post. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We, of course, will start with counterterrorism and phone records of millions of Americans being looked at, although the conversations were evidently not listened to, but phone records certainly were examined. The Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said the notion that we are eavesdropping on people is ridiculous, and yet some are saying the Patriot Act needs to be reexamined and all presidents just go overboard when it comes to dealing with the threat of terrorism. We'll be looking at the issue of Chinese-American relations with the president meeting with the president of China. 8-hour conversations in a beautiful place in California. What did they talk about? What are those issues? And a number of other things on the table today. Immigration, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Philip Klein, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this intelligence story, which has been all over the place the last few days, and now Edward Snowden has admitted, and he evidently is going to be prosecuted. What do you think about all presidents' reactions so far to the threat of terrorism? Have we gone overboard here, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is with these arguments is that, you know, the public debate is happening in a vacuum of information.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you could argue that, you know, not as many things should be secret and we should know about this and so forth. But obviously, clearly we recognize that certain things that the government does have to be secret because the terrorists can't know what you're doing or what your strategies are because that makes it easier for them to sort of change their methods. And so, you know, obviously it's always a question of what the balance is, striking the balance between trying to protect the country against terrorism and being careful of people's privacy and civil liberties. And I think that what often happens in these cases is that people jump on things based on their sort of either political biases or ideological biases, and it's not really... A lot of times the decisions the argument's not playing out in terms of what the actual information is. Now, there's some people that are saying, look, in principle, the government shouldn't be doing this under any circumstances, no matter what. And that's sort of one category. But there are other people that are arguing, look, in response to the question you asked, are they going overboard? The question is, we don't really know. I mean, yeah, it's perfectly plausible that government, sort of the executive branch, always wants to grab more power, and they're happy to use, national security is always the easiest way to sort of claim more power. And that's certainly a valid argument, and it's something we've seen throughout history. On the other hand, it quite might possibly be true that they've used this to thwart terror attacks and that this is a very important tool and so forth. But we don't really know. We don't know. We have limited knowledge of what the threats are that President Obama is seeing in his, daily intelligence national security briefings. So that's why it's sort of difficult to debate these issues often.
So what kind of knowledge do you think we need and how should we get that knowledge?
Well, again, I mean, a lot of it is going to be classified by necessity. I mean, that's one of the difficult things about having this debate is that the government says a given plot was thwarted by this, but if it sort of explains the whole trail of how they got to a certain plot using this, that may sort of reveal sources and methods to the point that they won't be able to use them with other terrorists and so forth. And that's the difficulty, is that some things by their nature have to be secret.
Mm-hmm.
The question is the government abusing that secrecy? And certainly I think with the IRS scandal and with the DOJ scandal and the fact that this is playing out with that vacuum, I think is often, it is problem, it is making it sort of, raising more suspicions. And I think another factor that's changing too is that since it's a Democratic president doing this, a lot of conservatives who are typically the party, who are typically more willing to sort of defend the government's, executive power in the name of terrorism and did during the Bush era, they're more critical of Obama.
So right.
You kind of have the civil libertarians who are critical of this type of thing with conservatives who maybe defend it if it's a Republican president, but not if it's a Democratic president.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are other changes, too. I mean, I think that the Republican Party has become more libertarian. I mean, you have more voices like Rand Paul and Mike Lee within the party that have sort of nudged the center of gravity on issues such as civil liberties and the balance between that and fighting terrorism. So
mm-hmm. Obviously, the reason, buddy, at least the stated reason for presidents doing this is to counter terrorism threats. What is your overall assessment? I don't think we have a good handle on how effectively we've been fighting terrorism. Do we have a satisfactory counterterrorism program in effect? Has it been effective?
Yeah, I mean, look, again, I mean, this is a question that's difficult to speculate on. One frame of argument is, look, 9/11 happened, and since then we haven't had anything such as a large scale of 9/11. Another way of looking at it is arguing that, well, look, terrorist threat was always overblown, and they got kind of lucky on 9/11, and that was sort of their big thing, but statistically, terrorist events are rare, and there really aren't that many terrorists, and we sort of overblew the issue. I mean, another argument is that, 9/11 was sort of this big event, but now they're sort of plotting for the new event, and they're sort of biding their time until opportunity strikes, and we let our guard down.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's some people would argue, they've sort of adopted a different strategy of more low-level things, or some people say that it's more, the kind of lone wolf model that we have to worry about, or people who are inspired. Someone like Major Hassan who shot up Fort Hood, or the Boston bombers, people who are somehow become radicalized and then carry out attacks, and they're not as clearly coordinated as part of, from overseas and so forth. So, I mean, there are multiple, if you read up on this a lot, there are multiple sort of schools of thought about what's going on. That's, and there's evidence to support the various views.
We have a number of people online who would like to speak to this very issue. We'll move into U.S.-Chinese relations and other issues in a moment, but I don't want people to wait too long, so let's start taking phone calls. Philip Klein is our guest, the first half of All Things Political. He's senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. Steve in Madison, hello.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, Steve, go right ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, the American Civil Liberties Union puts out a little pamphlet that's called The Constitution of the United States of America. And lest we forget, I would simply read for you the Amendment 4. So we put this conversation in a traditional context. So Amendment 4, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
So what should we do Do you think, Steve, as a result of this?
Obama is presidential. He's a constitutional attorney, scholar, and he's never going to present this viewpoint to the U.S. people, so it has to come from somewhere.
He's been criticized, as you know, Philip, because he is a constitutional attorney and lawyer, and some would say this flies in the face of what Steve just mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, the key thing is unreasonable. And obviously the big disagreement right now is this unreasonable? And obviously, the defenders of the program would say that, look, it's reasonable, it's limited, they're not listening in on phone calls, they're sort of just tracking sort of patterns of phone calls and so forth, and that's different than, and so that is still within the parameters of being reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And since they got a court order to do this, granted it was a secret court, but, I mean, the idea is that they got a court order under a process that had been established. They'd argue that it doesn't violate the First Amendment.
They say they're not listening in on phone calls, but I'll bet a lot of people don't believe that.
Yeah, and, again, I mean, that's what I'm sort of saying. I'm not trying to necessarily be, wishy-washy here, but that's sort of the point that I was making at the outset, which is that it's difficult to know, really. We don't know whether or not they're listening in on these phone calls. If your bias is to assume that the government is lying, then about issues like this, and you're sort of skeptical about what the powers that the government claims with regard to national security, then you're more inclined to say, that's a load of nonsense. They're probably listening in. Whereas if you're inclined the other way, then no, they're not listening in.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve, for the call. Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. I wanted to bring up this guy Snowden. He was a high school dropout. He got a GPA. He was discharged from the military because of problems. He worked for this contractor for just 3 months with this high clearance before he decided to do what he did. I guess there were no laws that are broken, so I guess what we need to do is look at who's writing the laws. Because if no laws were broken, no laws were broken. So, and I know it was Representative Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin that wrote the Patriot Act, or was a co-sponsor of it. And I wish that people who come and quote the Fourth Amendment would have been doing this when this Republican wrote this law. I wanted to get your guest comments on who this guy is, this Snowden is, and how these laws are written. And why we're not bringing up the fact that no laws were broken.
Philip?
Well, I mean, I guess the thing is that we don't really know that much about Snowden now. And I do think that the caller raises some valid questions about who this guy really is and how is he able to get this high security clearance. And I do think that there's a broader question of, are we giving too many people in these private contractor security clearance? And I do think that that's a strong criticism of the overall way that secrets are handled, is that it sort of undermines the argument that this sort of thing was handled with care if somehow this guy, who we don't really know, could somehow quickly get a security clearance and be able to, have access to all this stuff. And in terms of whether or not laws are violated, I mean, I think it's unclear now. I think that there are certainly laws against people with security clearance disclosing classified information. It's sort of unclear where this falls, and I think that him, the fact that he came forward kind of makes it really difficult for the Obama administration not to seek to prosecute him, because if he could sort of, just disclose this and nothing happens to him and they don't even attempt to prosecute him and there are no consequences, then you'd think that it would motivate others with access to secrets to want to leak them, feeling that there wouldn't be consequences.
Yeah, the director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, said over the weekend they have every intention of prosecuting him. I don't think there's a doubt that they will be prosecuting him. Let's welcome our phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political this hour. Philip Klein, senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner, is our first guest. Later, we'll speak with the political editor and White House correspondent for the Huffington Post. Here's the number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And you are always welcome to leave messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dave, thanks for the call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday, the American Players Theater, a true treasure in the state of Wisconsin, just opened its 34th season. They've kept classical theater alive in a beautiful setting for 34 years. We'll speak with two of the actors who will be a part of all of the summer's plays. Not all, they won't be in all the plays, but they are part of the cast, and they will be talking about Two Gentlemen of Verona, which they are currently starring in, and there'll be in other shows as well. All right, we continue with Philip Klein. It's All Things Political this hour. He is senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. We just have a ton of phone calls on this issue that we've been discussing, so we'll take a couple more of those. Hugh in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi. Representative Gingrich said on television the other night that one of the problems is that we are trying to collect data on everyone rather than targeting those most likely to be engaged in terrorist activities. The Muslims, we missed out. We missed out on the Boston bombers. We had very good reason to believe that these characters would be involved in terrorism. The parents are. Why did we fail here? Why did we fail in the Times Square, the attempted bomber there, and so forth? The thing is that we are failing with the system of not targeting the Muslims.
All right. Philip?
Well, obviously, just as there has to be, a balance struck between civil liberties and national security, there has to be, a balance struck between religious freedom and national security. I mean, I do think that, I think that's a crude way of putting it, the way the caller it sort of spoke, and, I wouldn't say that we should sort of wantonly just surveil Muslims and that's it. But I do think that he does bring up a point, which is that there are mosques within the country and where there are a lot of, where people are, which have become increasingly radicalized and which with radical imams and so forth. And it is sort of present a very difficult problem because obviously we want to protect religious freedom. We don't want to target one religious group. But at the same time, it's difficult to, there are clearly, very clear examples of people becoming radicalized. So how do you sort of keep tabs on that without sort of saying that you're going to somehow wiretap every mosque? It's a very difficult balance, and so it's difficult to say.
Thanks, Hugh, for the call. Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to say that a lot of the issues that are getting primary coverage relate, relatively speaking, to things that I would call piddly diddly, things that are not as important as the big picture, and the big picture, I think, lies in the economic issues. And I'd like to cite a magazine that covers different things that people ought to be looking at, and that's In These Times magazine out of Chicago. You can get it at Barnes & Noble and other places. And, for example, in the July issue, they're talking about Mary Jo White, who was Obama's appointment to the SEC, and how basically she sold us out in terms of the way she's doing the regulation there, and also pointing out that Bernie Sanders from Vermont and Congressman Brad Sherman from California are introducing legislation that would give the Treasury Department 90 days to identify commercial banks, hedge funds, and investment banks that whose failure would, quote, have a catastrophic effect on the stability of the financial system, and that these basic institutions should be broken up. Also, in this article, in this magazine for July, they cover some changes in the Colorado where progressives are banding together, realizing that the traditional Democratic Party and the Republicans just aren't getting it done. So I think that we ought to look at the real core issues for our security relate to economic issues and relate to the idea that the government, whether it be under the Republicans or the centrist Democrats, just aren't doing the job in terms of protecting us.
Philip.
Well, I think that that's a sentiment. Obviously, your caller is coming from the progressive point of view, but I think that there's a lot of sentiment both on the right and left, I'd say, you know, whether it's progressives or, you know, what has been called libertarian populists, who are both sort of skeptical of the bigness of a lot of these financial institutions and of the relationship between big government and big business. And I think that the Wall Street bailout sort of, and a lot of the subsequent bailouts, sort of created this odd alliance between the progressives and libertarians in this sense, which is that, progressives have always been suspicious of large concentrations of capital. Whereas what's happening now, what happened with the Wall Street bailout, is when there's a systemic failure, the government is going to step in and take on huge powers. And that expansion of government has created the suspicions of, libertarians, because they don't want to bail out companies. And libertarians think that companies should succeed or fail on their own merits, and that governments shouldn't try to bail people, bail businesses out or play favorites. And so I think that, does get, you're starting to hear people who are self-identified libertarians agreeing with Bernie Sanders in terms of breaking up the big banks, because they see a big bank essentially is a bailout waiting to happen, and almost as if it's another big government program. So I think that that's a very sort of interesting development that you might not have seen, 10 or even 5 years ago.
Thanks very much, Jim, for the call. Philip, I'm sorry the conversation was dominated, well, you can't help it, by pretty much one issue today, but it's what everybody is interested in. We thank you very much for being with us. Join us again, and we can get to the debt, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Philip Klein, a senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner, the guest the first half hour. Sam Stein joining us now, political editor and White House correspondent for Huffington Post. Our phone number remains the same. The issues, of course, remain the same, and we'll try to move this hour into a few other issues, although the surveillance and the extent of surveillance seems to have you concerned, many of you. Maybe some of you are not concerned by it. If you feel that we need this kind of surveillance to keep our country safe, is it worth sacrificing some of our liberties? What do you think? Our phone number for all of our conversations, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Sam, thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Our first half hour was pretty much dominated by surveillance, but we will entertain a few more issues this half hour and, of course, let our audience know they can still call in on that. I wanted to speak with you a little bit about the meeting that took place in what appeared to be a gorgeous place, Annenberg Estate in California, between President Obama and President Jinping, who spoke together for some 8 hours. Did you see them making any significant progress on certain issues, like North Korea? We've read that they talked about that they talked about global warming.
Yes. Well, you know, the progress that they make or will make will be seen in the next couple months, is my guess, and we won't hear about it. It'll probably happen behind the scenes because a lot of the stuff that they're dealing with is so delicate. So take North Korea, for instance. Obviously, China plays a linchpin in figuring out what to do with the nuclear weapons program. If they cut North Korea off in terms of fuel supply, we won't know about it publicly, but it'll probably happen in private. And then there's the whole issue of the security state, not to bring it back to what you were talking about in the past program or past half hour, but surveillance is a huge problem. And we've seen a ratcheting up of, I guess you could call them quasi-cyber attacks by the Chinese into America, and I'm assuming vice versa. And so it was interesting that on the eve of this meeting between the two leaders, news broke that the Chinese had hacked President Obama's 2008 presidential campaign along with John McCain's presidential campaign. And it also broke that the leaker of the NSA files, Edward Snowden, was in Hong Kong. So, you know, these are things that are very delicate, very sensitive, and they're probably going to take some more conversations for resolution, but this is a start, and it's probably an important first step because there hasn't been much of a dialogue on these levels between the two countries up until now.
After weeks, actually, of this threat, this huge threat of a nuclear war with North Korea and South Korea and who knows who else was going to be involved, this has pretty much disappeared. And I'm wondering, have the Chinese done some negotiations with the North Koreans that we just haven't heard very much about? Or what's happened?
Well, it's a great question. I wish I knew the answer. But you're right when you say that the threat level has sort of dissipated a little bit. It could have been simply the fact that you have a new leader in North Korea who wanted to flex his muscles, who wanted to show that he could be provocative. But what you've seen in the news more recently is a tamping down of that heat. There's been more talks with South Korea. I believe that they're opening up this factory again that they share. And, you know, I'm assuming that the Chinese are playing a role in this. There is an isolation aspect here that any leader of any country can't ignore forever. And I'm assuming that one of the things that the President Obama talked about was keeping up this pressure on North Korea to tamp down the rhetoric and, you know, come back to discussions about how to unravel the nuclear program.
What are the Chinese looking for? What would they have been looking for in the Obama and McCain campaigns? Why do a cyber attack? What are you after?
I don't know. What would you be looking for? I would guess probably maybe there's some talk, private talk about, you know, China policy would be my guess. It's the most obvious thing. It's the simplest explanation, but probably the most obvious one, which is, you know, a lot of campaign rhetoric is very heated. You talk a big game about getting tough on China, which in this most recent campaign was a huge theme for Mitt Romney. But behind the scenes, maybe it's a little bit different. You know, it's a different country, obviously. But if you recall back in 2008, there was a lot of tough rhetoric from the Obama campaign about cracking down or renegotiating NAFTA, the free trade agreement for the North American countries. And then behind the scenes, Austin Goolsbee, then a top economist for the campaign, later a top economist for the White House, was talking to the Canadians and saying, just ignore that rhetoric. It's not really going to be the case when we get into the White House that we're going to renegotiate NAFTA or anything like that. And so my guess is that the Chinese wanted some sort of similar reassurances, that they wanted to get a good sense of what the actual policy was going to be from these prospective presidential candidates, or these prospective presidents, I should say. So that would be one logical reason to hack.
We had another shooting rampage, this one in Santa Monica Community College. This guy had 1,300 rounds of ammunition. And yet the story faded pretty quickly, and there was no talk about, well, there were a couple of people who said, how could he, who evidently had a history of some mental problems, have access to these kinds of weapons and this kind of ammunition? It made me wonder, Sam, is this issue, except for what Bloomberg is doing, not going anywhere in terms of the administration speaking out on it as they did after Newtown?
It's a great question. Maybe we've become too desensitized to things like this. Maybe it requires a shooting along the scales of what happened in Newtown to make us motivated for any policy action. But this is, in a normal, sane world, a very tragic incident that would have caused a political fallout. We happen to be dealing with a lot of other things right now, so maybe our attention is distracted in that respect. But you're right. There's been no talk about revisiting gun control or legislation like that in the aftermath of this. I will say there is one thing that is heartening for gun control advocates going on out there, which is that while the attention has faded on the federal level, on the state level there's been some progress in various states, most recently in Nevada. And a lot of the big organizations, the Bloomberg outfit, for instance, and even the Democratic National Committee, are putting their resources and attention into the state legislatures, trying to make progress there. The problem is you end up with a patchwork of gun laws. You know, you can't prevent guns from, let's say, you know, Arizona being brought into Nevada, unless you just cramp down on the border there, but you're not going to do that. And so you end up with a patchwork of gun laws in which you may have, you know, pretty restrictive laws in Nevada, but it doesn't really have that great an effect because you haven't done anything in Arizona. And that's why you need a federal response. But yeah, it's in the wake of Santa Monica, you would have expected more talk, but it's just not the case anymore.
Mm-hmm. And before we go back to phone calls, let's talk just a moment about Nelson Mandela. He remains in the back of our minds, of course, because he's not well and has had a struggle with his health for the last few months. If you think about his life, what an extraordinary human being this man has been,
oh, yeah.
Hasn't he? I mean, the story is just incredible.
Oh, yeah. I don't think we'll ever see something like this again. To be in prison for, what, 27 years
plus?
To then get let out and basically, you know, accept the apology of your imprisoners.
Mm-hmm.
Say, you're welcome back into society. I hold no ill will against you. Then to lead a country through that process, which I don't think people understand exactly how harrowing that process was. I have a friend from South Africa who lived through it, and we were talking about it this weekend in light of the Mandela news. And she said, you know, it felt like every day that civil war would break out, that there were, you know, there was violence, there was threats. People were driving cars into, you know, schools, and, you know, it was just a country that was teetering on the edge. And to be able to make it through that and to establish this democratic society was, you know, an incredible accomplishment. And so, yes, you know, we're nearing the end of his life, unfortunately, but it's what an unbelievably filled life it was, and something that, you know, people will be talking about forever.
Yes, they will. A very important life. Sam Stein is our guest. This part of All Things Political. He is political editor and White House correspondent for Huffington Post. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email, use that if you want. Nobody has yet today, but you're ever so welcome to use that. talk@WPR.org. Two more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday, the American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin, opened their 34th season. Isn't it wonderful? They've kept it alive for 34 years. If you've never been there, it's absolutely beautiful. They do classical pieces, and they love Shakespeare, and so two gentlemen of Verona opened the season over the weekend. We'll speak with two of the actors who are in repertory with other plays, but they happen to have starring roles in Two Gentlemen of Verona. The theater is huge, beautiful, in the woods, outside, and it ranks as the country's second largest outdoor theater dedicated to the classics. So that's coming up hour two. Two phone calls now for Sam Stein, 800-486-8655. Tom in Madison is our next caller. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. Thank you to both of you. I'm glad we're all in somewhat sunny weather out here. Hope you get out there soon. On the issue regarding the enlightenment, I guess it is, of all of us once again, that the NSA is doing this trolling, or whatever you would call it, of all the various information technologies that are out there, much of which, you know, we supply through Facebook and everything else. Seems to me I remember there being a bit of a squabble back when, you know, the laws were passed because people were threatening to sue the phone companies for disclosing information that the government was going to use. And this is nothing new. We're blessed here in Wisconsin to have Russ Feingold, or to have had him, the only person that voted against the Patriot Act. And we were told these things were going to happen. It's been in the news for 7, 8, 10 years. I'm glad we're finally getting around once again to having the discussion, but I think most Americans will be content with having that information out there and available to the powers that be, as it were, to keep us safe. And, again, don't get me wrong. It's an important discussion to have. You wouldn't want people in any vital positions to put themselves in a position of blackmail because of gleaned information. But I think the big story is going to be if this gentleman that brought this to our attention again is taking a path to defect to China. He's been somewhat of a Chinese sympathizer. Now he's in Hong Kong, which is kind of a gateway for that. And again, China is a very huge issue. The fact they're taking over 60% of the Iraqi oil now that we have fought and bled and paid for. And there's so many things in the news. I agree with the gentleman before who said a lot of this is distraction, but we need jobs. People out here need jobs desperately. People need corporate welfare and the tax system to be revitalized and realigned to prevent some of the offshore money that's just sitting idle and get that back into being invested here. And again, I think a lot of these things are distractions. Meanwhile, anybody that's been reasonably informed has known this has been happening for 10 years.
All right, Sam.
Lot to unpack there. Let's start with the Chinese sympathizer angle. I think that's misinformed. If you read the interview that Edward Snowden did, he doesn't want to be in China. His goal is to get amnesty from Iceland or another country that sort of appreciates internet and press freedom. So I think he's in Hong Kong for specific reasons, but I don't think he's going to end up in Hong Kong. So I would quibble with that. With respect to the issue of is this old news, the listener's right in one respect. There's been different reports on this. USA Today, for instance, reported a while back, or several years back, that the NSA is collecting tens of millions of phone records. And so, yes, I think there was wide suspicion that they were doing these collections. However, the prison program, which it looks at foreign email correspondence, that is actually news to members of Congress who acknowledge that they had never even heard about it until 2 days ago, 3 days ago. I was on TV with Senator Jeff Merkley, who is very much in the know on these things. This is one of his, foremost subjects. And he acknowledged that the first time he had heard about PRISM was when The Guardian and The Washington Post reported on it. Now, if a U.S. senator, one of 100 people, doesn't know about it, I'm assuming that the public at large has no idea. We might have been suspicious of it, but we certainly didn't know about it. And finally, I would just add one more thing. There, while we may have known about this or thought about these in theory, in broad strokes, we certainly haven't had a robust debate about this. And part of the reason why we haven't had a robust debate about this is that it's been shrouded in this legal secrecy. And you can't talk about it if you know about it as a senator because you're supposed to keep it confidential. The legal justifications for these telephone surveillance programs are all done in FISA courts, and they don't get made public. All you know is that a FISA judge said yes to a request, but you don't even know what the request is and how broad it is. Now, you can make the case that, yes, there are important issues out there that are being marginalized because of this, like jobs, which I would argue is a vital issue, obviously. But this is a major matter. This gets to the bedrock of our country, our constitutional rights, our rights to privacy.
Yes.
And I don't think we should downplay it. I think this is, if anything, one of the biggest issues, one of the biggest news stories of the past 3 or 4 years, since the collapse of Wall Street, I would say. And I think we need to actually step back and, ask logical questions about what kind of security state we want to run. It could be that we support this type of thing, but we really haven't had this type of debate since the signing of the Patriot Act, I would argue.
Well, it says something. I'm not sure what it says, so you could tell me what it says. But it says something that you have a fairly conservative president, Bush, preceding, some would say, a somewhat liberal president, President Obama, both feeling on this particular issue that all steps need to be taken to counter a terrorism threat, you know, and skip civil liberties, skip, you know, what the democratic ideals are. I mean, Obama's a constitutional lawyer, for heaven's sake.
Correct.
Why does everybody, what's going on with that? Why does everybody fear terrorism so much and feel that we have to give away some of our liberties?
That's the million-dollar question. You know, it's funny because he is a constitutional lawyer, and part of his appeal in 2008 was reining in executive power. I mean, this was a big thing where he said we can't have this false choice between security and privacy. The two go together. We have to uphold our values even when we're doing our national security operations. And about the time when he became the Democratic candidate in the general election and not the primary election, was when he started to shift. Now, the question is, as you noted, why? What was it? Did he see something in the national security logs that really freaked him out, that made him understand that there is a vital aspect to these things? Perhaps that's the case. Is it just that it takes a really strong-willed person to, you know, decrease the amount of power he has as opposed to increasing the power he has? That could be it, too. You know, it's an impossible question to answer because we just don't have the information.
Right.
And we never will really have the information about what he sees and why he justifies this. But you're right. It's weird that the guy who ran as this constitutional lawyer, the guy who's going to rein in the Bush executive overreach, has just basically expanded it.
Right. Tom, thanks. Cynthia in Verona, hi.
Hi. Two quick points. One in response to an earlier caller who was asking whether or not what Mr. Snowden did in releasing those documents, whether or not it had broken any laws. I myself held a security clearance when I worked for a defense contractor, and yes, indeed, he broke laws. It is illegal to disclose classified information. The two criteria that are in effect as to whether or not you can disclose such information are, number one, whether or not the person you're disclosing it to has an appropriate clearance, number two, whether or not they have a need to know. That was not the case here. So Mr. Snowden did indeed break the law. Second point, we should all keep in mind that this data was collected legally. Many of us may disagree with the Patriot Act, and we disagree with the secrecy of the FISA court, but warrants were issued by that court in order to collect this data. So as much as we may be annoyed by it, it was legal. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. I think we forget sometimes, don't we? Who's the reporter from the Post who did this huge expose on how many buildings in Washington now are devoted to counterintelligence and counterterrorism and how much money? It's just, it's a huge, huge program, isn't it, Sam?
Oh, it's massive. And the Washington Post series that you're talking about is called Top Secret America.
Yes.
And it was done several years ago, and it was an extensive investigation, multiple years, if I remember correctly, just about the totality of the universe of our national security apparatus. There are, you know, Washington, D.C., where I live, is basically a city built on government contracting. And the vast majority, I would say, of government contracts have to deal with the national security state. If you drive on the beltway, on the parkway from Washington to Baltimore, you will pass Fort Meade, Maryland. And there was an exit on that says for NSA employees only. As in, you can only leave the beltway if you're an NSA employee. Don't you dare get off that exit ramp if you're not. It's symbolic in a way. It is its own town. It is its own village. And a lot of it we don't know about. And what's sort of the macro story here for me, which we haven't had much of a discussion about, but what's amazing to me is how much time and resources and energy, legislative energy, we put in to the national security apparatus. We devote so much, you know, effort to this. And I'm not saying it's the detriment of other things, but can you imagine if we put this much attention, for instance, to domestic security, to making sure we had enough policemen on the street, for instance? We just don't do that. We have a very acute fear of
terrorism that mm-hmm. compels us to make these amazing steps. And we should have a debate whether we think that's worth it. I think it's a valuable debate to have, and I think that's the real value of these types of disclosures, is not so much that they're revealing stuff that maybe you and I already know about or thought we knew about, but that it should compel us to say, okay, now that we know the extent to which the government is going for this, maybe we should think about it and ask, is it worth it?
I think it's a valuable conversation to have. You're right. I don't know if we'll ever have it, but it makes sense. Whatever happened to the hunger strikers at Guantanamo? There's another story that was...
You're throwing so many stories at me. I remember we sent someone down to Guantanamo, a reporter, Ryan Riley.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he talked to them. And, you know, it's a bad situation. It's you can't help but, you know, try to wrap your head around what to do with these people, because obviously they've been there. They've been there for a while. They have not been tried. We want to close Gitmo ostensibly. The president says he does, but Congress is impeding him. And then there's a whole issue about whether force-feeding these people is a form of torture or whether it's, you know, the moral thing to do. And they, as I understand it, and I might be wrong about this, but many of them are still on hunger strike. It's just our attention has moved elsewhere.
Right. Thanks, Cynthia, for your call. Steve in Menominee. Hi.
Hi. How you doing today, Kathleen?
All right, Steve. How are you?
Great. You know, this is such a huge issue. You know, I'm originally from California, spent a lot of time throughout the United States, spent 20 years in Arizona, and there's such a wide open border in this country that, you know, we have a lot to be concerned about with the amount of people crossing our borders illegally. You know, I mean, I'm an American citizen with, you know, I mean, just, I love this country, and, what really hurts me is the fact that we're even having a problem with this. The only people that really have a problem with this are the people with money, lots of it, that are trying to hide what they're doing behind back doors. People that have, you know, other agendas that are more concerned about, you know, putting things under the rug than being open and transparent. I mean, if you are John Q. Public like myself, you've got nothing to fear. Let the government come in. Let them check me out. Let them monitor me because, you know, the worst criminal isn't the one behind bars.
All right, Steve. Thanks very much for the call. Sam.
Well, in theory, yeah, fine. If I have nothing to hide, why should I care that the government has, you know, knowledge of who I'm calling and who's calling me, and, you know, if I'm emailing a foreigner, perhaps they can see what the contents of the email are. Yeah, in theory, that's fine. But in practice, you know, you can see where the slope is, where the slippery slope is. You know, what if, you know, someone who is wrongly accused? What if someone in government wants to use that for not, you know, entirely altruistic or, you know, benign means? The problem is when you start talking about sort of the abstract issues and, you know, do we have a constitutional right to privacy in this regard? So, yes, I understand what the caller was talking about. I think a lot of members of the Hill have made that same case, which is, I have nothing to hide. I shouldn't be worried about this. And, you know, God knows that the private companies are all compiling the, you know, the contents of my email and looking into it so they can target my advertising. But, you know, there is a slippery slope that I think a lot of the civil libertarians are right to argue about.
Yeah. One more call. We may not have time for a response. Claire in Germantown. Hi.
Oh, hi. I listened to Coast at night, and there was a retired FBI guy on there, and he was adamant that the law should be changed. If he investigates a drug guy, he can get the records immediately. If it's the enemy, he has to wait 3 days. Who put that law in place?
I'm not sure what law that is. Sam, is that ringing a bell with you?
Not really. I honestly don't know what law that is.
Yeah. Sorry, Claire. Send us more information if you have it, and we'd like to know. Well, all right. 30 seconds for you, Sam. What are you looking forward to covering this week, sir?
Oh, God, there's so much. You know, there's the immigration debate that's happening, but the basic thrust is going to be what happens on the Hill, off the Hill, with respect to this NSA revelation.
Right.
Glenn Greenwald, the reporter for The Guardian, says more is coming, so we'll be looking for that.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
Sam Stein is political editor and White House correspondent for Huffington Post. He's a contributor to MSNBC. We also thank Philip Klein, senior editorial writer for the Washington Examiner. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, KP Whaley for our on-air production, and thanks everybody for all of your calls and interest. Just a reminder that you, if you felt frustrated because your thoughts weren't formulated till after you heard the conversation or you didn't get through, you can always leave messages for us, and we try to be up to date with postings of shows that are coming up, at least the day before they happen, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show, is the name of the Facebook page. News is your way momentarily, and we will continue our Monday morning conversation. American Players Theater kicked off their 34th season. Ain't it something? 34 years. So we'll talk with two of the actors. So stay with us.